Welcome to the Open Systems Media eCast, sorting out sensors, software, and processing for automotive safety and autonomous drive. I'm your moderator, Brandon Lewis, here with today's speakers, Jay Thomas of LDRA, Vijay Rantala of Texas Instruments, Nicholas Keel of National Instruments, and Andrew Longhurst of Wittenstein. I'd like to start by more formally introducing our speakers, beginning with Jay Thomas, who is Director of Field Engineering at LDRA Technology. Jay has worked on embedded control simulation, processor simulation, mission and safety critical flight software, and communications applications in the aerospace industry. His focus on embedded verification implementation ensures that LDRA clients in aerospace, medical, and industrial sectors are well-grounded in safety, mission, and security critical processes. Our second presenter today is Nicholas Keel, Group Manager for Automotive Product Management at National Instruments, where he has been employed for the last 9 years. Starting as an applications engineer, Nicholas has served in product marketing and management roles for the last 7, primarily focusing on embedded software and test technologies for autonomous vehicles. In the three-hole today is Vijay Rantala, R&D Manager for Millimeter Wave Products at Texas Instruments. Vijay obtained his bachelor's degree in electrical and electronics engineering in 1998 from BITS in Pilani, India, and in 2000 he obtained his master's degree from Iowa State University. He then joined Texas Instruments in Dallas, where he held various positions in the wireless business unit for close to 10 years. In 2009, Vijay moved to Kilby Labs, which is a research center inside Texas Instruments, where he worked on millimeter wave CMOS design and designed a 160 gigahertz CMOS radar. Since 2012, he's worked as the R&D manager for the Radar and Analytics product group, focusing on 77 gigahertz CMOS automotive radar. The cleanup presenter today is Andrew Longhurst, who is the business manager for Wittenstein. A skilled product leader with extensive background in electrical, electronic, and software engineering, Andrew is able to deliver an in-depth understanding of the challenges faced by embedded engineers in the safety-critical sector. Andrew has been in the medical, aerospace, and automotive markets since 93 and has worked on developing flight-qualified systems with a focus on quality assurance at Wittenstein since the year 2000. Andrew holds a bachelor's in electrical and electronic engineering and a master's in robotics and automation. He can be reached at andrew.longhurst@wittenstein.co.uk. Now on to a couple of housekeeping items before we begin the event, starting with the features of your audience viewing console. The presentation today consists of roughly 50 minutes of presentation with an audience Q&A session at the end, which we encourage you to participate in. To participate in the audience Q&A, use the Ask a Question text box by simply typing your question into the box and hitting the Submit Question button below. You can submit questions at any time during the course of the presentation, and we encourage you to do so early and often. We'll address as many of these questions as possible during the closing Q&A, and if you have questions about the eCast operation itself, feel free to submit those, and one of our technicians will be happy to assist you. The Enlarge Slides button on the audience viewing console will allow you to maximize the presentation slides to fill your entire screen. The Download Slides button lets you download and print the slides if you prefer to follow along with a hard copy. The Forward to a Friend button lets you send an email address that includes a registration link to the CCAST so that your friends and colleagues can also attend. One last reminder is that all Open Systems Media eCasts are copyrighted and may not be recorded without prior permission. And after all that, we are ready to begin, and I can hand it off to Jay Thomas of LDRA, who's going to be kicking things off. Jay, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Brandon. I'll get going with our title slide. So again, we're all going to be talking about the same topic, but we're going to present our own distinct view on it. In terms of my view on it, I'm going to present a brief agenda. We'll talk about autonomous vehicles, and really the focus is in autonomous systems. And how do we know the systems are doing what they're supposed to? And that's where we're going to bring in functional safety concepts, show case study, and show how we can show compliance to functional safety as our systems continue to get more complex. So to begin with, let's talk about autonomous vehicles. And what are autonomous vehicles? They really go from level zero, where there is no autonomy, to level four, where we just give the destination and the vehicle does everything else. And the reality is we are somewhere in between. Now, where we are exactly depends on who you ask. But we are moving together, both as an industry and as consumers, to this area where more and more of our vehicle driving operations will be completely autonomous. And to get there, we have to scale a lot of walls in terms of making sure our systems operate the way they are intended to and making sure they operate the way they are designed to. And that's where I like to think about an autonomous vehicle is not just an entity into and of itself, but it is a system composed of many subsystems, each of which needs to operate correctly and needs to communicate with the other parts of the system correctly. And if we take a step back to the previous slide, as each of these elements have become more intelligent over the last few years, the concepts of functional safety have allowed us to make sure that even though the mechanical systems with limited sets of discrete functionality have been replaced by automatic systems that can do just about anything, the functionality remains the same. As these systems become autonomous, we're going to keep applying those concepts of functional safety to make sure each of the parts operate the way that they are supposed to, and to make sure that as we add increasing functionality, the functionality will operate the way it is supposed to. And this is a little part that I thought was interesting, and part of this is also because LDRA comes from doing a lot of work in aviation for a long time. If we look at aviation systems, they are millions of lines of code. For instance, a Boeing 787 has around 7 million lines of code in its flight computer. With a modern car, the code isn't in one place, it is in many places. Each of the subsystems below, from airbag systems, anti-lock brakes, automatic transmission, alarm systems, not to mention entertainment systems, which in themselves may have tens of millions of lines of code and be able to control many of these other systems. So we're talking about tens of millions of lines of code with the modern car, and we anticipate this to become more complex. So how do we make sure that when we went from, if we look 10, 20 years back, all of these were mechanical systems, how do we make sure that they operate the way they're supposed to, and how do we take that to the next level? The key concept there is functional safety. And functional safety has been around for a few decades, but it's become more and more formalized as the systems have become more complex. And IEC 61508 is an overarching standard that covers much of industrial functional safety, and there are specializations called ISO 26262 that specifically deal with functional safety in automotive systems. There are also other specializations for other industries that perhaps we'll cover in another talk. But just to talk about automotive safety for a second, ISO 26262 introduces a concept of automotive safety integrity levels, where they vary from level A to level D, where systems of level D require the highest degree of, have the highest degrees of risk and require the highest degree of rigor to attain. And how do you attain that? And also, what types of systems might it be that require the highest level of rigor to verify? To talk about that, I'll talk about a case study. Now, this represents a real customer, but I'm not going to name names here. But the customer produces rear view camera systems. And it's kind of an interesting microcosm, that whole idea of autonomy. And again, we're talking about something electronic that has replaced something physical. The physical instrument is a mirror. You look back and you know your mirror is going to work, and if it doesn't work, you adjust it. And then with the rear view camera, it works quite differently. So if we look at a rear view camera, the required safety integrity level is actually level D. Now, why is that? Because the cost of failure is very high. Potentially, a child dies, and the probability of failure is also very high. Vehicles often go backwards. So what are the types of items that we should do to attain that level? To attain that level, we need to do items such as requirements-based tests, such as fault injection, and make sure our code works with respect to coding standards and other verification modes. So to talk about that for a second, let's talk about the verification methodology, which includes statement, branch, and MCDC coverage. So I'm going to continue and show a little bit about how we typically implement that. Talking about ISO 26262 for a second. So these challenges typically center around requirement traceability, meeting coding standards, data and control flow coverage, and structural coverage analysis. And to fit into the standard, to fit into the process model, we'll look at tool qualification, process objectives, and verification and the evidence trail. So again, we're only going to talk about each of these briefly, but the high-level perspective is that of system engineering. What you see on the screen is the V diagram of system engineering. So in terms of ISO 26262, we're looking at bidirectional traceability from software safety requirements through to your architecture, through to your unit design and your source code, and making sure all of this works through verification at each level as well. Coding standards compliance is also a key part of ISO 26262 and other coding standards. 26262 specifically outlines a number of goals, such as enforcement of low complexity, which are often best addressed using an overarching coding standard, but can also be fulfilled via specific verification guidelines. But again, the background here is our goal here is to perform these checks early in the software development lifecycle so that we'll be confident that our software works throughout the rest of the lifecycle. Coding standards adherence also bridges this gap between security and safety. And we often think of these as a Venn diagram. There's a lot of overlap between safety and security, and that in area where they intersect is actually really important. That's where many of the faults occur. Code complexity and quality metrics are also a good way to ensure uniformity, clarity, maintainability, and testability. These are all ways to make sure your code is uniform and you can reuse it through the rest of your life cycle. But in my view, structural coverage is the most important way to make sure your software does what it is supposed to do. And generally speaking, it should be performed both on the unit level as well as the system level. On the unit level, to make sure the subsystems and the units operate the way they are supposed to do, and the system level to do the same tasks for higher level tests. These goals are often best achieved by performing these activities on a target setup. And that's because the code often works differently in a target environment versus a host environment. So we supply a lot of tools to be able to do that. But beyond that, the other key to the process as a whole is keeping track of the artifacts so that you can track your testing to your requirements. And that's really the key to functional safety, making sure that you define what your software is supposed to do and making sure that it does what it is supposed to do. Beyond that, LDRA offers tool qualification support. Because we've been around for over 20 years and widely recognized by regulators, we can provide these assets for a variety of areas, including rules checking, structural coverage analysis, and low-level tests. And these results are also recognized by standards bodies in ISO 26262, such as TUV. But to conclude this discussion, ISO 26262 provides us a way to make sure our code does what it is supposed to do and allows us that assurance as we replace what was originally a mechanical system with automatic systems of more and more complexity, we make sure that it continues to work the way it is supposed to do. So to achieve this, using a tool with a proven track record allows you to make sure you're releasing a safe product and make sure that you can get your product to market, approval from your regulators, and also save time and money because you've done as much of your testing as you can early and you're confident that it works the way it is supposed to do. Now, I have a questions slide, but we'll talk through questions later, but I just wanted to provide the email and then pass it back to Brandon.
Thanks, Jay. Good stuff there on tests and, most importantly, compliance with ISO 26262 across all the ASIL levels for ADAS and autonomous drive. That brings us to Nicholas Gill, who's going to talk about a little bit of the things that are about some of the things that National Instruments has been doing in the test space around autonomous drive and ADAS. Take it away, Nicholas.
Thanks, Brendan. So here I'm going to talk today about testing systems, sensor fusion systems primarily, that involve a combination of one or more either cameras, radar, or other physical sensors on the vehicle. I'm sure you all know, modern vehicles with active safety systems involve all sorts of different types of sensors that really weren't on the car 10 or 15 years ago, including ultrasonic sensors for some of the backup assist, cameras, a wide variety of cameras, short and long-range radar, and then the new trends are that we're going to be incorporating more and more things like LiDAR into the vehicles to drive the vehicle. We're adding a whole bunch of different sensor types, and in addition to the emergence of new sensor types, we're also incorporating a series of new sensor and embedded software control system topologies. So you can have kind of a series of smart sensors, so to speak, where you've got onboard embedded software running on the sensor itself and communicating over a basic bus like something like CAN back to a central ADAS ECU. Or you could have a series of, we would call them dumb, or sensors without embedded software built into them, streaming high bandwidth data back to a common ECU. Things like the NVIDIA DRIVE PX2 is an example of that, for where we would pass lots of high bandwidth data back to the central processor. So there's not a common architecture. It's a series of different architectures that might be used from vehicle to vehicle, and this introduces all sorts of new challenges. And a big part of that is this concept of sensor fusion. Here we have an example of a collision mitigation system on with something called a RayCam, which is essentially an integrated radar sensor combined with a forward-facing camera, all integrated into one. So in this case, if you were to want to test that piece of embedded software, the software running on that device, you would really need to be able to simulate the world around the sensor and the ECU by both generating radar signals as well as generating some sort of real camera data, whether that be a camera stream or a video stream that goes straight to the sensor, or generating a scene around this device. You need to be able to generate real signals so that the ECU and the sensors think that they're in the vehicle. So this presents a very, very interesting challenge from the concept of both signal generation as well as time and synchronization. There's the conceptual problem, or the implementation of integrating with these new types of I/O, certainly a much larger variety of testing will need to get done as we move from kind of the level one, level two active safety to move towards an L3, L4, L5, or we're getting to autonomous vehicles. The volume of testing that needs to go up, or it needs to be incorporated, is much, much higher. We're talking about getting to billions of miles driven. We need to be able to not only drive the car around in the real-world environment, but do as much of the testing as we can in the lab. And that involves generating artificial scenes, but real-world signals to make the sensors think they're actually in the vehicle. So I'm going to talk a bit about how we might go about doing that, kind of on a sensor-by-sensor basis, as well as how we would incorporate that into a sensor fusion-based system. So we'll start with radar. I'm sure most of you know that the general trend in the automotive radar space is that we're moving to a higher bandwidth. We're moving from kind of the 24 gigahertz range of automotive radar into the 77 to 81 gigahertz, which gives us certainly more reliability, more granularity to be able to kind of generate a more accurate picture of the world around the sensor. It also gives us a different series of ranges. So it provides a lot of values, but it also provides a great deal of challenges in that the millimeter wave technology means that we have to account for things that weren't really as important before, where we're talking about testing a radar sensor in the face of different types of paint, different types of bumper material, where you put the sensor in the vehicle. All of these things have a dramatic impact. And so you're going to need to be able to incorporate a lot of flexibility as the nuances of these things change. So here's an example of a test system that actually takes a kind of a baseband RF signal and generates objects based on an FPGA algorithm, generates object information at the 77-81 gigahertz spectrum to really enable the testing of these sensors for a variety of objects and give you things like radar cross-section, Doppler shift, so to target both size and velocity and trajectory of an object in front of a radar sensor to both validate that the sensor itself works, but then it can also be incorporated into a larger system, a sensor fusion system, to generate a scene for a vehicle test. We'll get into a little bit more about how that would work. If we're going to be able to test those cameras, there's a few different ways, and it really is going to depend on the type of topology that we use. But a couple of the common elements that are representing challenges are we've got more and more cameras, and simulating those, so we could take the car and drive it around, but if we want to move the testing into the lab, generating real conditions inside of a scene generator, inside of a software environment is very challenging. You've got to be able to account for things like lighting and shadows and glare, which can sometimes be very difficult if you're trying to test things in a controlled environment like a lab. So one topology that we may have is we may have kind of a series of smart cameras, and if we're testing both either the camera or the ECU, we might kind of just point the camera at a screen and kind of drive around in a virtual environment and let the cameras detect objects and let the ECU drive commands. And this was certainly earlier in the 8S development and testing phases. This is a very common topology, but as the number of cameras goes up, this gets increasingly difficult. So something that we might be moved to is a series of smaller, less intelligent cameras, but a higher performance ECU, a GPU-enabled ECU that's able to process all of that image data, all that video data, but we still have the issue of having lots of cameras, lots of scenes that we need to play back. And as the cameras go up, the number of cameras goes up, this certainly gets more and more challenging. So the next phase, the next iteration of this types of test are to basically be able to generate a GPU-based video stream that enables you to parallel process a lot of image data and then send that to the GPU-enabled ECU. And one of the benefits of this, again, using the FPGA technology, is not only can you stream high volumes of parallel data, you can also manipulate frames and manipulate images to generate all sorts of different lighting effects, inject errors to really exercise the algorithms running on the ECU to try and kind of break the ECU or exercise all of the different corner cases. This gives you a lot more flexibility, and this is one of the areas where we're seeing the industry evolve, is really being able to manipulate these video streams. And as we get into machine learning, this is going to be the way we're going to be able to try and really fool machine learning algorithms, is by this bit-by-bit manipulation. So those were different ways we might test a couple of different sensor types, but as we get in and we want to test the algorithms running on things, we want to combine this sensor simulation or stimulation, generating these real sensor signals, with a traditional hardware loop testing environment where we're going to simulate in math, simulate vehicle dynamics, chassis configurations, road conditions to really drive the virtual car around an environment. And to do that, you're going to use a hardware-in-the-loop test system. So you're going to connect your ECU in amongst all of the sensors with this bigger test system. So a generic agile test system, which will then get connected to the scene generator software. Here we have a software that's capable of doing mathematical vehicle dynamics, scene generation, also capable of generating sensor information, so the sensors that aren't there, to really drive the car around this virtual environment. So when we put it all together, this is an example of what this might look like. So in this case, we've added VDEX as well, but you've essentially got a camera ECU, a radar ECU, and a VDEX ECU with their corresponding sensors all tied into a real-time simulation system with a real RF signal generator and GPU-based video generation all connected together. And we can certainly discuss this more through Q&A later. But this is an example of what an HIL system might look like. And this incorporates that sensor fusion concept. As we've talked about, we've got in the case where we're trying to test an ADAS ECU, cameras and radar working together. So in this case, we would detect an object using a basic radar system, and then characterize that object using our camera system. So be able to tell that, hey, there's an object moving at a certain speed and a certain distance, and it's a person or it's a dog or something like that. But a big cornerstone of that is being able to synchronize that information. That's a really big part of this. So in this case, we need those components to make it to the ECU at the same time. And if we're simulating the world around the ECU, if we're simulating camera feeds or radar feeds, that data needs to get to the ECU at the same time. So if we're taking this and taking the radar and the cameras and we're injecting this through a test box, we would need both of those test boxes to be able to send data to the ECU simultaneously using a common clock, common backplane, which is what the PXI platform enables us to do. Or we would need to essentially have one system being able to generate both the radar and the video signals, which is kind of the flexibility that we get using something like the PXI platform. So when you put it all together, the sensor fusion and the time synchronization, we'll come back to this picture and spend a little bit more time on it. This is what that common timing and synchronization enables you to do is synchronize things together so that your sensor fusion ECU is seeing the same thing from the different sensors at the same time to really understand the world around it. You can exercise that software by generating a whole series of errors inside of that system. So this is a quick snapshot of kind of the way the industry is evolving and what National Instruments is doing to address some of those challenges. So with that, I'll give it back to Brandon.
Wow, thanks, Nick. That's a really good comprehensive overview of all of the technologies involved in autonomous drive of the future. I want to remind the audience really quick, keep submitting your questions, keep them coming, and we'll address as many as we can in the closing Q&A session. At this point, let's hand it off to Vijay Rantala of Texas Instruments to talk about some millimeter wave radar. Vijay?
Thank you, Brian. I'll be talking about the millimeter wave sensing and imaging trends. I think in the previous talk, we actually discussed the radar. The millimeter wave band is actually referred from 30 gigahertz to 300 gigahertz. The name the millimeter wave comes from the fact that the wavelength is in the range of millimeters. They have some unique properties. They can be generated electronically. The spatial resolution you can achieve is between millimeter and a centimeter. The antennas can be very small, almost the size of a package. The cost and area and power are relatively high. But again, they have unique properties, like I mentioned. They can actually see through fog, rain, snow, which are not typically possible with camera-based systems. That makes them very attractive for very safe autonomous driving kind of requirements. Now, if you look at the trends in the automotive radar, in 2012, there are some cars in the market, typically luxury cars. They have these radars. Primarily for long-range LRR applications, with primarily adaptive cruise control, and maybe some blind spot detector, typically at 24 gigahertz sensors. But what we are seeing now is that the 24 gigahertz band is being phased out in 2022, and the applications with the 77 gigahertz radar are also proliferating a lot. Now in 2020, we expect each car to have between 1 and 12 radars that comprise of long-range, mid-range, and short-range radar. And also they're actually providing what they call it park assist with a 360-degree cocoon where you're sensing entirely around the car. And this actually makes this makes the usage of radar very important because of their unique properties. Now, moving forward, how the automotive radar evolved in the last 15 years. I would call it the previous generation, sometime around 2005, between 2005 and 2010. The radars are typically made of gallium arsenide chipsets. The antennas are very bulky, typically with the waveguide plates. They have these individual modules, one for the transmitter, one for the receiver, one for the ADC. Most of them are at a wafer level. And moving forward, in 2010 to 2015, I think the radars evolved into still discrete. They're still and very expensive solutions, but they were somewhat integrated. But still, they're very complex with the critical signal routings on the PCB. Very unconventional packaging with bond wires hanging off on the PCB. These kind of systems are very prone to noise, and there is a difficulty in the observability, specifically for safety constraint systems. Today, we actually are proposing a single chip radar at 77 gigahertz. It is extremely small in size, very simple design. They have built-in monitoring and calibration functions. It provides very high resolution and less false positives, and it has a programmable core, all integrated in a single chip. This is what we believe will be the future of radar as we look forward to. Now, one key comment about what is enabling this technology. We believe at TI the technology that enables this is actually CMOS. If you look at the CMOS based on the ITRS roadmap, the modern CMOS is approaching the silicon germanium processes in terms of FT and FMAX. These are the transmit frequency and the maximum oscillation frequencies. And more and more, the backend optimization is becoming increasingly important to realize the gains from the transistors. So what TI believes in is the next generation radars will be of CMOS. Now, a quick note on the automotive applications. There are multiple applications in automotive radar that are now emerging. For example, for a long distances, 150 meter plus, typically where you're expected to detect a car or a big truck, we call it RCS, which is a radar cross section. These applications include adaptive cruise control and automated highway driving. Between 100 and 150 meters, we have automated emergency braking and urban driving. For 20 to 100 meters, we have pedestrian detection, bicycle detection, blind spot detection, etc. And between 5 meters and 20 meters, we have the proximity warning and parking. Of course, there are new emerging applications inside the car that requires even finer resolution between 2 centimeters and 5 centimeters, specifically for gesture recognition and driver monitoring. Now, I'll spend a few minutes on the radar concepts. FMCW radar stands for Frequency Modulated Continuous Wave Radar, where the frequency is ramped linearly over time in a sawtooth fashion. The various targets show up in discrete tones, and here we have the transmit in red color, and the black color is the receiver. The difference between them in time will translate into a frequency difference, with the two targets showing up at different distances. In this case, target 1, which corresponds to a distance of D1, and the target 2 corresponds to D2, and these two actually show up as a distinct frequencies. Now, if I further delve into the signal processing of the radar, there are, after the sensor portion, after the millimeter portion of it, there are multiple steps that happen in the back end that includes the range FFT, Doppler FFT, and a coherent integration, and finally the detection and angle estimation algorithms. More in terms of visually, the data, which is actually frequency ramp data on the bottom left corner, in fast time is actually sampled, the ADC data comes out. And when you take a range FFT, each of these objects will show up across the chips. And now we further process in the Doppler FFT, you would actually get each individual target unique signature. And here we are representing that as a identified targets. Now, how is the information encoded here? The radar range equation I'm showing here on the bottom side. There are multiple variables here, but at a high level, it is proportional to the output power, the gain of the antennas, and finally the range. As you can see from the equation, it is a park loss of 40 dB per decade for doubling the distance. So this is something to keep in mind. One important parameter that we need to keep in mind is the radar cross-section, which varies depending on the object. For example, trucks have a radar cross-section between 10 to 100 meters square, and a car between 1 and 25. Adult is between 0.1 and 1, and a child is even significantly smaller. Now, moving on from a range and velocity processing perspective, there are parameters like, for example, the range is encoded in the intermediate frequency that I'm showing in the equation here, and the range resolution is encoded in the sweep bandwidth. Range accuracy is proportional, inversely proportional to the bandwidth and the signal-to-noise ratio you receive, and the velocity resolution is inversely proportional to the total observation time. And the maximum unambiguous velocity is inversely proportional to the chirp period. Now, there is one fundamental trade-off that we face chirp slope with respect to range resolution and max velocity. High chirp bandwidth for the same slope means it reduces the maximum unambiguous velocity. A low repetition time for the same slope will reduce the range resolution. The FMCW high chirp slope will actually break this trade-off, providing benefits to both. So we believe that going forward, the next generation automotive radars are converging towards the fast FMCW as a modulation scheme. The other important parameters from a chirp generation perspective, any integral nonlinearity will lead to a smearing of the spectrum. That means that a specific object will not look like a single object, but actually looks like multiple objects. And any differential nonlinearity in the linear chirp will translate into ghost objects, which means that object that doesn't exist actually shows up as existing in the data. The way to solve this is actually through closed-loop PLL, which is possible in CMOS. So we believe that using CMOS, we can achieve extremely linear chirps with closed-loop PLLs. Now, quick comment on the multimode radars. The mid-range radar for city driving typically look into up to 150 meters, whereas the long-range radars will typically look in 270 meters. Using the techniques like TX beamforming and phase shifters, we believe that we can achieve both applications simultaneously with the same sensor, and this is what we call the multimode radar. Now, what is the advantage of using CMOS? With the availability of the dense digital cores on the same die and the direct proximity of analog to digital, we can actually create new system topologies. We can actually improve the monitoring performance at production tests as well as in the field, and we can do in-field calibration to stabilize the performance over aging and environmental conditions. What I'm showing you here on the bottom side is how this actually takes place. It almost reflects like a software-defined radio behavior where the RF signal path we actually sense and we actually use digital to process and correct the RF imperfections. The other interesting feature that gets enabled with CMOS is the complex baseband. Traditional FMCW receivers uses only real-only baseband, and the information is present only in the half of the spectrum. But with the complex baseband, we can actually separate the noise and the signal into two different bands. Now, this would allow the image band information can be used to detect interference, which is will become a huge problem in future, especially with the car, multiple cars having radars. It also allows direct compensation of antenna delay mismatches in digital baseband. Now, just to recap, what are the summary of the future radar needs? We have we need a linear wide bandwidth frequency synthesis for fast RAMs. We need to have a scalable number of receivers and transmitters with TX modulation that supports MIMO and beamforming that could actually generate MIMO radars, essentially multimode radars. We need to have high dynamic range basebands with the tens of megahertz of bandwidth. We also need to have comprehensive monitoring to enable adaptation and calibration that would allow level 4, level 5 autonomous driving solutions. And finally, it needs to be a compact and a low power solution to enable cheap housing and also the hidden placement behind the bumpers. Now, with this, I'll talk about what the solutions that TI offers. The millimeter technology at TI actually started since 2009. We kicked off the project, and since then, in 2011, we produced a chip, which is a 160 gigahertz radar for gesture recognition purposes. And finally, in 2015, we produced the first, industry's first CMOS radar at 77 gigahertz front end. And 2016, we produced the industry's first 76 to 81 gigahertz single chip radar with integrated DSP. Now, the TI radar family, just to talk about it, it's actually built in completely in CMOS. The package is a very friendly flip chip PGA package with low loss transition to PCB. And we offer a range of solutions from none to the full DSP. For example, AWR 1243 is a front-end only device. AWR 1443 is a front-end plus MCU, and 1642 is a front-end plus MCU plus a DSP. At high-level specifications, we offer a noise figure of 15 dB and output power of 12 dBm and a phase noise of minus 94 dBc, which are on par with the silicon germanium solutions. Here is an example, a snapshot of what we are able to achieve. The form factor for this solution, the EVM, is actually could be as small as 2 by 2 centimeters. With an antenna of 10 dBi gain, we were able to demonstrate a car at 177 meters. That is the capability of this device. To conclude everything, the millimeter wave sensing delivers high accuracy and resolution that plays a critical role in emerging automotive driver assistant and driver replace systems. Flexibility and scalability are required to satisfy the wide range of applications for different ranges and fields of use. And modern CMOS, we believe, will enable all the applications with a single chip solution from RF to information radar. Thank you. Thank you very much. And Brandon, back to you.
Thanks, EJ. A lot of questions coming in about what's going on in the automotive radar space. That takes us to Andrew Longhurst of Wittenstein, who is batting cleanup today. Take it away, Andrew. He's going to overview some of the software components of autonomous drive.
Hi, I'm Andrew Longhurst, business leader for Wittenstein High Integrity Systems, a company that specializes in the supply of safety and mission-critical real-time operating systems. Over the next 10 minutes or so, I will briefly explain my thoughts on how good embedded software engineering has enabled cars to become safer, and the challenges facing engineers developing software for autonomous driving systems. There's a certain amount of overlap in my presentation with the other presenters previously, but hopefully I could provide a pretty good summary to sort of finish this presentation off. The first question we should resolve is, what is automotive software? Well, there's lots of it, and it covers a very broad range of features. One way of classifying software functionality within the vehicle is by how much control the software has over the vehicle. Firstly, there's the software within the command, control, and information systems. These provide functionality including engine management, powertrain, braking, external lighting, instrument panels. They allow the driver to safely control the vehicle, but can't take control over the vehicle itself. Then there's software within the vehicle's comfort, usability, and infotainment systems, managing climate control, windows control, central locking, interior lighting, heated seats, seat adjustments, etc., etc. These make your driving experience easier and more enjoyable. However, if the software within these systems fail, they would only become an inconvenience to the driver. Going to the next level, we have software implementing advanced driver assistance systems, or ADS for short. These systems can take limited control over a vehicle. However, the driver is still within the control loop of the car itself. Then there's the software that will implement autonomous driving algorithms. Here the car uses a very broad array of sensors to make sense of its environment and takes full control of the vehicle. The result of all this software development? Driver and pedestrian protection has moved from impact survival to active avoidance. Volvo Cars has even has a vision that by 2020, no one should be killed or seriously injured in a new Volvo car, completely taking the driver out of the loop. So within the vehicle, there are many systems that rely on software. And some of the software will have to influence safety-critical functionality. Generally, the more control the software has over the vehicle, the more systems and sensors it has to collect information from. The software becomes complex and processing intensive, but will still remain very responsive. As a result, to keep drivers, pedestrians, and the built environment safe, development and integration of safety-critical software is being driven forward by international design standards and regulation. As mentioned before, there's ISO 26262. Part 6 of ISO 26262 specifies the requirements for the development of software for automotive applications. ASIL D is the highest possible safety rating under this standard and is achieved by performing a risk analysis of the potential hazard. It examines the severity, exposure, controllability of the vehicle's operating scenario. However, if you're developing generic software component, say for example an RTOS, the final application where the software will be used is not known. Hence, the software will have to be certified as a safety element out of context. When designing such software, assumptions will be made about its safety goals and the ASIL level required. These safety goals are described within the safety manual along with the installation and integration instructions. Developers using the software need to confirm that the safety goals defined during its development meet the requirements of their project. It's also going to be interesting to see how ISO 26262 standard, which uses a traditional requirements-based approach coupled with a procedure-based verification structure, will be able to support the use of software implementing artificial intelligence and machine learning within safety systems. An interesting ISO 26262 requirement is the expectation that software runtime verification monitors will be used to detect, indicate, and handle systematic faults within software rated ASIL C and D. So despite the fact that all your software has been designed and verified following a robust and vigorous safety critical development cycle, there is still the requirement of self-verification of the software. For example, many modern RTOSes include a range of built-in error checking functions. However, to fully satisfy this requirement, some RTOSes provide a plug-in module that provides a task monitoring capability, ensuring that scheduling of the task is occurring as intended and within an expected time frame. These types of task monitors can be used as an input to trigger an external watchdog if a fault should occur. Then there are software coding standards. MISRA C coding standard is widely used across many market sectors. MISRA C is a set of software development guidelines for the C programming language, initially developed by MISRA, which stands for the Motor Industry Software Reliability Association, but now widely used across many safety critical industries. Its aims are to facilitate code safety, security, portability, and reliability in the context of embedded systems, specifically those systems programmed in C, by providing a restricted subset of standardized C programming language, which is deemed to be safer. However, please remember, having a good coding style is only one small part of the overall solution. It does not replace a need for a formal design system. On a modern connected car, there could be no safety without security. A quick search on the internet will result in cases of car hacking. Hacking attacks include remote access using the car's cellular network connection, or close to the vehicle via the tire pressure monitoring system, or connected to the vehicle via the onboard diagnostic software. In the safety world, there's ISO 26262 Part 6 for software development. However, for security, there is no such dominating, overreaching standard for software development. There are security standards such as the Secure Hardware Extension, or SHE, which defines the operation of a security module. There are also guidelines resulting from the European-funded projects Evita and Preserve, and others as well, but no one overall go-to security software development standard. As for coding standards, there's CertC from the Software Engineering Institute, which provides coding guidelines for those developing software that requires a degree of security. In general, security is normally implemented by a combination of software, with hardware providing acceleration and isolation. When developing for automated security, software developers need to consider such features as verify boot. Does the device contain the correct software at boot time? Authentication, is the device I'm talking to the correct device? Public-private key management, encryption, decryption to keep the data safe, and isolation. Access should be restricted to the intended devices only, and software should disable all unused ports or unwanted points of access. Security software should also be isolated from other software. How this is achieved depends on your selected hardware platform. For example, ARM provides TrustZone, Synopsys ARC provides Secure Shield. Good isolation can also be achieved by using the processor's MPU MMU correctly. Having software that is both safe and secure is an interesting mix. Traditionally, once safety software has been designed and verified, which is very costly and can take a long time, changes to the software tend to happen very infrequently. Whereas, as we all know, security patches come out almost daily. AUTOSAR is a worldwide development partnership of automotive industry parties. Its objective is to create and establish an open and standardized software architecture for automotive electronic units easy to use. AUTOSAR provides a standard software development base for industry collaboration on basic functions by providing a platform which continues to encourage competition on innovative functions and promoting the reuse of software components. AUTOSAR uses a three-layer architecture. Firstly, we have basic software, standard software modules that provide a hardware abstraction layer. Then there's the real-time environment, which is middleware, which abstracts from the network topology and inter and intra ECU information exchange between application software components and between basic software and the applications. Then lastly, there's the application layer, which provides a common software API for automotive applications in terms of syntax and semantics. For most systems, a quick software boot time is essential, placing the car into a working and safe state as quickly as possible. Responsiveness is very important. Things happen very fast at 80 miles an hour. To manage this, most automotive architectures support parallel processing. Hence, the software we need to support core-to-core communication and synchronization. Due to cost, space, or procurement constraints, automotive software within a single processor may have to provide functionality supporting different safety integrity levels. To do this, the developer needs to ensure software designed to support lower safety integrity levels cannot interfere with software designed to support higher safety integrity levels. This problem is normally solved by using the processor's memory protection unit, whereby specific memory regions will be allocated to software sections that have been designed to the same SIL level. This can be achieved by selecting an RTOS that supports task separation and isolation by using the processor's underlying MPU infrastructure. Here, each task is allocated to its own memory regions. Each time there's a context switch, the new task is activated and the MPU registers are reprogrammed with the memory regions relating to the new task. If the software tries to access a memory region outside of its permitted range, an exception will be triggered. So, that's a very brief overview of the challenges facing embedded software engineers developing safety software for autonomous automotive applications. Safety, security, integration, and managing software containing a mix of different safety levels. It's complex and time-confusing, but help is at hand. The market trend is to construct automotive software from pre-existing modules. Many of these modules have been pre-certified against ISO 26262. Pre-certified software modules provide a robust and reliable mechanism for building software. Watch out for the words certifiable and certified. There's a big difference. It's best to pick up pre-certified software that has been designed and verified upon your specific processor compiler combination. If possible, even down to your version as a compiler and your compiler settings, as it removes the need for retesting on your target hardware. If you're considering using pre-certified software modules, you should also consider using a certified compiler as well. You can use a similar sort of approach for your safety case. All the software examples I gave today are based upon SafeRTOS, which is our safety critical real-time operating system. SafeRTOS is an ISO 26262 ACLD pre-certified real-time operating system certified by TUV-SUD. SafeRTOS supports the isolation and separation of tasks as standards using the processor's MPU, MMU mechanisms. It's available with a sophisticated task monitoring system called Checkpoints, and it's also available with an OSEC OS wrapper, which allows its integration into an AutoSci environment. And that's it for me, and back to you, Brandon, for some Q&A.
Great. Thanks a lot, Andrew. Some good insight there about integrating OS components. That brings us to the Q&A portion, which we're going to do in a lightning round sort of fashion in order to get to as many questions as we can. We have a lot of them. And we'll take it all the way back up to the top with Jay. Jay, is certification being driven by automotive manufacturers, industry or government regulation? What's driving that?
At the moment, we're seeing the automotive prime manufacturers drive this the most. But we're also seeing some very specific interest and inquiries from import-export regulators. So it would be nice to have an overarching framework, but we're not quite there yet, but we're moving in that direction.
Yeah, the auto manufacturers probably want to stay ahead of the game rather than be dictated to. Would you agree?
Yeah, definitely, especially if it means they can't move their vehicles around.
Great. Now next to Vijay. Vijay, you went over some of the different types of radar that are being implemented in cars of the future. Does that mean that every car has a different radar for a different purpose? And if so, because it does, how is the architecture of these various radars implemented throughout the car? Are they in different places? Are they in the same package? How are they integrated?
Yeah, I think the exact integration path of it is still evolving. I have seen architectures that actually place anywhere between 4 to 20 sensors around the car in various places. For example, I have seen cases where there are 3 sensors in the bumper, front bumper, 3 in the side, 3 in the back side, and there are a few more in other places. But the long-range radar, for example, typically sits near the grille of the car. So all these things will exist. That's my expectation, because each of them is serving a specific purpose. From an integration point of view, the architecture itself is evolving, whether you need to have sensors at the end and only the data coming to a central processing unit at the center, or you have the processing is already done near the edge and only the object data is sent to the final decision-making processor. So that part of it is still evolving, but my expectation is, yes, multiple sensors will be needed to ensure a 360 degrees coverage around the car, specifically for autonomous driving.
Great. One real quick follow-up question is there any interest in non-CMOS-based processes for automotive radar?
Yes. I mean, actually, if you look at the current systems, many of the systems are built with the non-CMOS. CMOS, in fact, TI is the first company to actually come out with a product in CMOS. So that means that for the last 15, 20 years, all the solutions to it exist today are indeed based on non-CMOS. CMOS is actually, I would say, commercializing this, if you want to call it, or bringing the cost down to a point where it become affordable for not just the luxury cars, but the other cars as well.
Great. All important in the automotive industry. Next up is a question for Nicholas. Nicholas, you had a diagram that showed some of the processing moving from distributed to more centralized and now sort of a hybrid approach. You'd assume with all of the different sensor inputs that are coming in to autonomous cars and ADAS applications that you're going to need to have some sort of centralized processor there to fuse all of that data. You referred to it as sensor fusion.
Right.
Does that bring up any reliability or fallback redundancy sort of issues were something to happen to that centralized processing platform?
No, that's a good question. So I think in the short term, the short term, it will probably move back to the driver when we still have steering wheels in cars. I think there's a lot to be learned from the aerospace industry in this account with regards to redundant centralized processing unit. In an airplane, you've got redundant everything. And I think as we get to the point, we've probably got some time, but when we get to the point where we're actually pulling the steering wheel out of the car, that's absolutely going to have to be the case, regardless of how high reliability these embedded software devices are, these ECUs are. You're going to need a fallback. I think we've got some time before that's an absolute requirement. I think the regulations and the standards need to be put in place. Again, though, I think the DO-178 standards provide us at least a template if we were to try to use our crystal ball and look into the future. That's kind of where I see us moving, is we will have redundant sensor fusion area or driver assist ECUs or autonomous drive ECUs, but we've got some time.
Great. One last real quick question for Andrew. Andrew, are you seeing the need for a total vehicle operating system, kind of piggybacking off that last question that I asked Nicholas, that is going to have to manage all of these different inputs? And then how is that going to integrate with a general purpose operating system that's maybe used for infotainment? And do you need a certain type of processor to be able to handle the switchback between the RTOS and the GPOS?
Not what I'm aware of. I mean, my experience is we're dealing with processing modules these days, which are hugely powerful. So we're talking bits of silicon with sort of many, very large cores upon it itself, each of the core having a specific function. So you would have a operating system handing in networking, an operating system handing in the vision crunching system, one handing the ADS system itself. So it's still very broken down and dispersed itself.
Great. Unfortunately, that brings us to the end of our time today, and those of you who had questions we weren't able to get to, we'll make sure to have the appropriate representatives follow up. I'd like to thank J. Thomas of LDRA, V.J. Rantala of TI, Nicholas Keel of National Instruments, Andrew Longhurst of Wittenstein, and we at Open Systems Media, LDRA, NI, TI, and Wittenstein would also like to thank you, the audience, for attending today and making this possible. This eCast will be posted online at the URL shown on your screen within 24 hours, and an audio-only podcast will be made available there as well. You can do a web search for the keywords embedded space e-cast and find all of Open Systems Media's eCasts available for download there as MP3s. Thanks again for attending, and have a wonderful day.
Thanks, guys.